As for the delivery.
Go ahead.
Hi, so I apologize for our delay in getting started. My name is Jim Dottavio, currently acting as the Director of Technology Transfer. This seminar today is basically an introduction to technology transfer at WVU. And I'll go to the second slide to introduce our team. As June Anderson is the one who set this up. She's in the lower left-hand side. We're also going to have Chris Mancini and Hamid Badi presenting today. Chris and Hamid are usually going to be your primary point of contact for technology in our office. They're technology commercialization specialists. And June is a great resource as far as providing access to agreements and information. Other folks in our office that you'll probably have connections with. At the bottom, you'll see Christina Anderson and Rhonda Evans. They will be helpful for you in terms of if there's any financial things, Rhonda will typically handle that. If there's technology questions related to your disclosures and such, Christina can help there. There is Angela Schock is in our office. She runs the TransTech program. And on the right-hand side, you'll see we have some interns in our office. These are folks that help us get things done. In health sciences, you may see David Stanton and Jessica Allen. They're basically technology scouts helping us to get disclosures and information from for technology. We have three interns that help with agreements. You'll see Eric Winnott, Mackenzie Milam, and Thomas Motes, and they will help if you need agreements. We also have Dottie Dillon, who has recently joined our group to help us with social media. So hopefully you'll be seeing more stuff from our office coming up in the future. The next slide. It just shows that, you know, what we basically do here in tech transfer, we're trying to encourage invention and innovation at the university. Now, what we try to do is help generate income. When we do agreements, we typically try to generate licensing revenue, but we also try to help folks get funding for their research. We also look to contribute to economic development. You know, part of what we're trying to do at the university is get startups. So we'd love to see the technology actually commercialized to develop jobs and help the economy within the state and even nationally. The next slide just is a reminder that, you know, before you do research and before you talk to people, we'd like to remind you to do agreements with the entities. You know, agreements that we see most frequently include non-disclosure agreements, material transfer agreements, and if we're working with another institution, institutional agreements. And what these do is they help us make sure that, you know, first with non-disclosure, that we protect any ideas that you have. Once these ideas are out, we can lose patent rights and other rights to them. So we want to make sure that we have these agreements in place up front. Material transfer, just make sure that as we bring material in or send it out of the university that it's protected. Both in terms of intellectual property, as well as any liability that can go with those materials, and understand the rights that folks have. The institutional is if we're collaborating and we have joint inventions, we make sure that we understand, you know, who owns what, who's going to protect it, and who will commercialize it. Those are just some of the ones that you see most frequently. The next slide talks about why we encourage you to disclose intellectual property. So, you know, first of all, we all have employment agreements with the university, and all that we do is subject to the Board of Governor rules. So in those rules, the university requires that you disclose your any inventions or creations to our group. We also have a requirement that if you're getting government funding, that you disclose it, and then we have to report it to the government. Ultimately, what we would love to do is protect your inventions or creations and license it. And if we do that, you receive a major share of the revenue generated. And we also believe that when IP is developed, it helps prove you know, the level of achievement that we do. So it improves our scholarship level, our student success, and, you know, increases our ability to get government funding. The next slide just explains a little bit more about the revenue distribution that we do. So if we do license the technology that you invented, and let's say that we get a license agreement with that. And let's say that there is $100,000 of sales under that agreement. We would then distribute that money. If we filed a patent application, the first thing we do is we subtract the patent application. So if you look on the right-hand side, that $100,000 of income is reduced by that $20,000 we spent on the patent. And the remaining amount is $80,000 is distributed according to Board of Governor rules, 40% to all the inventors, which would be the 32,000. The university retains 32,000. And then we also would give a portion of that 10% each to the college and to your department. So that's in funding additional research. Looking at the next slide, slide 7, one of the questions we're often asked is who owns the intellectual property and under what conditions? Now, the university does not claim to own everything you ever invent, but what it's looking for is, you know, first, is it within the scope of your employment? And if it is, generally the university is going to own it. Or if it's not within the scope, but you've used facilities and other resources, you know, perhaps other researchers, then it again will probably belong to the university. And then lastly, we ask, did somebody sponsor this research? You know, even if it's not in your employment, we have an agreement with a third party or with the government, then they would have potentially rights to it. So we would look at all of that. If none of those exist, you would probably own the invention. And again, in those instances where it does belong to the university, we ask that you submit a disclosure. You know, we'll help determine whether it's patentable and how to how we would approach that from the university's perspective. The next slide kind of runs through the same thing for copyrights. They're a little bit different than inventions. So again, if you contributed to an original creative non-patentable work, typically we would look to copyright protection for that. And copyright is generally anything that you conceive that's creative. As long as you've reduced it to some sort of a media, it's potentially protectable. The rights are vested upon creation of the work. You don't have to register it, but it's recommended to register it in order to protect it and commercialize it and enforce it. Once that's done, you know, basically what we ask when you do create something, if you've given a third party interest in the work, for example, if there's an agreement that says that somebody else owns it, obviously that third party would own it. That's if, for example, under sponsored research or you know, a work for hire or something like that. Secondly, if that's not in place, then if it's an institutional work, the institution would own it. But if not, we would then say, is it computer software? And again, if it's software, the university would own it. But if it's something that you created that's not an institutional work and not software, typically you would own it. Again, we would encourage you to contact one of us if you have any questions and you know, to help you make that determination. You know, the best course of action is to disclose, and you know, we can tell you if it is not university property or if it's something that you need to disclose. So you know, feel free to contact any one of us in our office. I'll go ahead and pass the presentation off. I think Chris is next.
Sorry, I had myself on mute there for a second. I was just going to delve a little bit slightly into more of the copyrights and patent terminology and what to look for when working with us in your research in our office. So just a general background on, you know, what is intellectual property or IP? You know, it's intangible property, right? It's a property created by the intellect and not considered naturally occurring. In the sense that it can be owned, sold, licensed, willed, used in the, for example, as capital in a lawsuit even. So the four sort of legal pillars that we often talk about with IP are copyrights, patents, trademarks, and trade secrets. Historically, our office has, you know, filed some trademarks for folks with the university. Trade secrets are, you know, essentially more so handled on information that we would like to keep protected, but not necessarily patentable. In those instances. And like I said, we, you know, we primarily work with patents and invention disclosures and in some capacities, copyrights. So copyrights, just to build a little bit more on what, you know, Jim said, you know, the idea isn't protected for a copyright, but the tangible expression of the idea is. And the crux here is that, it, you know, it has to be considered minimally creative. You know, you typically can't copyright a basic, you know, database of information, a phone book, for example. You know, you have to cross that threshold of minimal creativity in order to get a registered copyright. So by it being fixed in a tangible, you know, medium, you know, that's referred to as a common law copyright. And similar to patents, you know, it's a right to exclude others from copying, distributing, displaying, and making derivative works. I can't remember the exact term, but, you know, there are certain, for example, for educational purposes or for newsworthy purposes, you can splice out small pieces of information that is copyrighted, but for newsworthy or teaching purposes, you know, we can present, you know, small aspects of that information for those circumstances. Registration is not necessary. You know, for example, if you, you know, create homework for a class, you know, by creating that homework and putting it down on, say, some engineering paper, you have a common law copyright, but at the end of the day, does it have any sort of monetary value? Highly likely it doesn't in most cases, so you wouldn't, you know, want to pursue registration. So it's typically, you know, you pursue things that you want to protect and have, you know, sort of perceived value, you know, to protect the registration. Copyright periods are typically long. If you author the work, 70 plus years, or if it's a work for hire, 95 plus years. And over here on the right, there's a few, you know, world, and I'll say new world examples with, you know, websites, the front end of a on-demand Netflix display, you know, software as copyrightable code, anything minimally creative, right, in a tangible form. That's what we're talking about here. So moving on to patents. So by definition, you know, a patent is a temporary monopoly extended by the patent owner, by the federal government. And it is in exchange for essentially full disclosure of your potentially patentable technology. And essentially it's a way for the government to ensure that, you know, innovation, you know, it incentivizes innovation, you know, in society. So, you know, even in the, starts off in the U.S. Constitution, so it was a pretty important early on. Similar to copyrights, it's a right to exclude others for making, using, selling, or importing. And however, it does not give the owner the right to actually practice the invention, just your right to exclude others. And it's a possibility that your patented technology can actually still infringe other patents. The major key advantage that Jim talked mentioned earlier is, you know, by disclosing and protecting technology in a patent, you can ultimately hopefully earn licensing fees and royalty income, and, you know, sue, stop infringers, you know, and you essentially can maintain control of the technology as the owner of the patent. So those are the key advantages. Just some basics on, you know, if you're looking at your research and you're trying to determine, you know, whether or not it's you have something that may be potentially patentable and worthy of disclosure to our office. So essentially to invent something, there's two stages. It's called the conception of your inventive idea and a reduction to practice. So once you've conceived of your idea, you know, there's two fundamental ways you can reduce your invention to practice. You can develop a prototype, which is referred to as an actual reduction to practice, or, you know, you've demonstrated your process in the real world, obeying the laws of physics. So that's one way of reducing it to practice. And the other is what's called a constructive reduction, meaning you've simply described your invention in sufficient detail to hand to somebody that, you know, has ordinary skill in that inventive area to be able to read it, understand it, and it's a teachable document for them to potentially reproduce your invention. So those are the two main pillars for invention. Legally, the government requires you to present the best mode, even though it's typically not legally challenged. It's just part of the law and disclosure. And the must-haves for patentability, this little mountain over here on the right teaches sort of the steps in order of ease to complexity in achieving a patent. So the legal categories that your invention has to fall into is that it either has to be determined as a composition, you think metal alloys, combinations of compounds and elements, an article, you know, possibly like a stamped cookie sheet that doesn't have an operate or have a function, I should say, a machine, you know, that operates. You can have, you know, nail clippers or a machine, a giant bulldozer's machine. Everybody typically knows what a machine is, or a process. And that's where software can fall into. It's a, you know, it's procedural steps, starting from one point and getting to the other. So some type of method. The next, you know, fairly low bar is that you have to, you know, demonstrate any type of usefulness of your invention. The next stage, getting a little bit more complicated, is, you know, you have to have at least one new element to the world, your invention, you know, so that all the prior art beforehand becomes, you know, important and makes it a little more difficult to patent. And then the last one, and arguably typically the hardest hurdle to get over, is you have to demonstrate to the patent office that what you came up to was not necessarily obvious to one of ordinary skill. So you've invented something, you have surprising results, it has immediate, you know, marketability and saleability in the marketplace. You know, there's all sort of various factors that indicate, you know, hey, this is worthy of inventing, patenting, and procuring rights to. The last slide I'm going to touch on here is the types and timelines for utility patents. There's essentially two types. The first one I'll go over is a provisional patent application. And we're a first-to-file country. We've finally caught up with the rest of the world in that regard. We used to be a first-to-invent. But essentially what it means is, you know, if a provisional patent application is an assemblage of documents, references, written material, your constructive reduction of practice, if you will, that can be put on as a placeholder or a reservation with the patent office to establish your filing/priority date. And it never actually gets examined or issued into a patent, but you know, it can be referred back to as reference material being on file with the office. You have up to 1 year to rely on that information that you've put on reference to file then a U.S. utility or non-provisional patent application. And that's one that actually, you know, it's a much more formal application, and it'll ultimately get examined and possibly issue into a patent in time. Most patents can issue 18 months to 5 years, depending. You can pay a little bit more money to the patent office to prioritize your application and maybe get to issuance into a year or less. And that temporary monopoly/patent term length is typically 20 years from the date of the non-provisional application filing. So some bright line timeliness rules that we often have to go over with folks that are disclosing to our office that are very important is ideally, you know, we would love for you to keep essentially your invention secret and not disclose it publicly or publicly use it. That preserves all of our filing rights, both domestically and foreign. A little less ideal is that, say, you've published a paper or dissertation and announced it in some way publicly up to 1 year prior, we can still file an application if we're within that 1 year of prior window and at least attempt to procure U.S. Patent rights. If you've disclosed it essentially over a year ago, we lose all rights, both U.S. and foreign. Okay, so these are pretty critical time gateways here. The last little slide, and I'll hand this off to Hamid here to talk about a little bit more of our process. But in general, our invention disclosure form is sort of the engine that you guys fill out and we process and evaluate and go forth for our process. It's how we record all of our technology reporting. Essentially, if you have a quality, you know, write-up of a description of your invention, the majority of this form is just bookkeeping, you know, making sure that you list your contributors, that public disclosure history that I mentioned was important, and attaching that detailed description. So I'll hand it off to Hamid to talk about our process.
Great. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate that. So now I'm going to talk about the processes, like what goes on in the office. So let's see, can you hear me? Hello?
Yep, we got you.
Yep.
Oh, perfect. So now let's say you have an idea and now you're deciding as to whether or not to disclose. I think, you know, what I suggest is, you know, either if it's in health sciences or life sciences, you call me, And then you and I, you know, we can discuss whether or not this validates an invention disclosure completion or whether or not you need to, you know, reduce it to practice, you know, further the stage of the development of the phone. We'll discuss it, and then we'll decide whether or not we should disclose it. Once we decide you should disclose it, you complete the invention disclosure form. It's on our website. You can download it. If you have problems doing that, I can, you know, I can send it to you. That's what I usually do, you know, with the PIs that I'm working with. I'm sending them the invention disclosure as a PDF. They download it, and they just complete it online, send it back to me. Once they send, we do a preliminary in-house prior art search on the idea. You know, we like to see what the landscape looks like. Who else is doing what? What other universities are doing, you know, doing research in the same space? We like to look at who's patented similar ideas in this space. You know, this kind of gives us an idea as to whether or not if we'll be able to overcome rejections from the patent office, from the standpoint of, you know, these are good things that we do and have the invention disclosure to a third party for a commercialization assessment review. This gives us, this commercialization assessment gives us a unbiased opinion as to the commercial opportunity of your invention. Is it, will the invention be commercially viable if it's taken to market? Will there be a return on investment for the university? So, you know, this commercial assessment provides us with feedback as to what the university is looking at if it takes on the burden of the patenting expenses associated with patenting your idea. Once I received the prior art report back, I received the commercials act. TTAG is the tech transfer assessment committee meeting. You know, we have myself, the whole, you know, Chris and Jim with OTT. We have the dean of the business school. We have Vantage Ventures. And then we have a representative from the general counsel's office who attend that meeting. And then we collaboratively decide as to whether or not we should patent this idea. And there are a number of different variables that we take into consideration, you know, when deciding as to whether or not to patent. But let's say, so basically, you know, we have to make a go, no-go decision. So let's say we make a go decision, we patent it. So what we do is we connect you with our outside counsel who help you draft the claims for a provisional patent. Once that's done, you know, we have a priority date. Now what we need to do is we need to start marketing. So I like to take this to market for the next 10 months because we have a 12-month deadline that where it has to come back to TTAG, and then we have to decide whether or not we're going to convert this to a non-provisional. So I take it to market. I mean, I wouldn't be able to do this without my team. I mean, I have to give recognition to David Stanton and Jessica Allen who help, you know, who do a majority of the work with, you know, prior art searches and marketing. And then, you know, we take it to market. We try to get industry collaboration. And also we send it out to the third party assessment firm as well to do marketing on our behalf. So it's a, you know, it's a good marketing effort that we put into place. And then based on feedback that we get from industry, we decide whether or not we want to file a non-provisional, you know, the non-provisional or a PCT. This gives, the PCT gives us another 18 months to, you know, vet the technology and see if it's providing us with a return on investment. So, you know, we like to go after either licensing opportunities. We like to spin out or do startups, you know, from the university. If needed, you know, we can help, help you connect with some VCs or angel investors that would be interested in learning more about the technology. So that's kind of what we do with the go decision. What happens with the no-go decision? So there's two things that can happen with the no-go decision. Either we return the rights back to you and, you know, you can run with it, protect it, and, you know, do what you please. and we'll enter into an agreement with the university and the inventor as to what they should what they should do once we release the rights back to you. Or we can wait 6 months because, you know, we strategically, we think it's not a good idea for the patent office to start, for the clock to start ticking. So we'll wait 6 months, we'll reach out to the technology now and whether or not it's it's at a good stage for us to start protection on it. So that's the second option. And these are what we do with go, no go decisions. Next slide, Chris. So these are the timelines. You know, this is how long it takes for the process that I just discussed. Once you complete an invention disclosure, it takes around 4 weeks for us to get the prior art search and also the commercialization assessment report back from the outside party. And then we take it to TTAC within 8 months, because TTAC meets once or twice a month. And so depending on where the disclosure falls, it could be anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks that we take the invention disclosure, the prior art search, and the commercialization assessment to the meeting. Once it's taken to the meeting, it takes another 3 to 4 weeks for the idea to get filed if we decide to go with it. That's, you know, that it takes 4 weeks because, you know, we have to connect you with outside counsel. You have to have a conversation with them, talk about your idea. They like to talk to the inventor and, you know, get their perspective from their voice as to what the invention is so they can draft appropriate claims for the idea. So that takes another 4 weeks. And then from there we market, and then, you know, hopefully at the end of the tunnel, we look for a licensee or a spin out or startup from the university. Next slide, Chris. Again, this is just a summary slide. If you need any NDAs or MTAs or IAs, please feel free to check us out on our website. You can always email us at technologytransfer@mail.com. And, you know, we can provide you with those documents if needed. And Chris, myself, Technology Transfer, you know, we're the resources that you need. Chris handles all the IP coming out of Statler. I take care of all the IP coming out of the health sciences and life sciences. And if you have any other questions, you know, don't hesitate to reach out if you need my cell phone number. I know we're living virtually right now, so you're not going to, you know, you won't be able to get me in my office, but you're more than welcome to call me on my cell or send me an email. Thanks.
June, did you want to maybe go over the, just the, what's coming up in terms of the Lunch and Learn series or comment?
Sure. Yeah. So as you guys can see from the slide, we have a robust Lunch and Learn schedule for this semester. They will all be via Zoom. We will be recording them, and we will share presentation information after the fact for those who cannot attend. But this is our schedule for the fall semester. We've got connecting with the WVCTSI coming up next. We've got the ENCOVA Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, Vantage Ventures, information about the NSFI Core Short Course, and then introduction to the Statler College Innovation Hub, and then finally, an overview of OSP. I will be sending out those invites. I usually start sending out the invites about 2 weeks prior to the date of the presentation. And once you RSVP to me, I will go ahead and send you the meeting invite with the Zoom information like I did for this one. And that will be coming from the technology transfer email. It's just kind of easier to do it that way. And then the next slide, Chris, is a new series we have. We've partnered with the Vantage Ventures team, and we have an SBIRS-TTR webinar series launching this month. The first is with NASA on September 17th, and then we have the Department of the Navy, DOE, and then NSF. And so again, I'll be sending out invitations about 2 or 3 weeks prior to the event date. And then for these, we actually have Eventbrite registration, and that link will be provided in the email. I did send a first email out about a week ago. If you didn't receive it, just go ahead and send an email to the technology transfer email address and I'll add you to our list and forward you the information. I can also reply to everyone who attended this webinar with the flyers for each of these event series as well. That's it for me.
Great, thanks, Jim.
Are there any questions? Okay, well, as Hamid said, if you guys get in, end up having any questions after the fact, both Hamid and Chris are available and you can always send an email to the technology transfer email address and that will get forwarded to the appropriate person as well. Thank you for hopping on. And again, apologies for the brief delay with the tech issues. Thanks, guys.